Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, U.S. media are celebrating an economic recovery, but most Americans aren't at the party. According to a recent NBC poll, just 18% say the economy is excellent or good. So whose recovery is it, exactly? Today we'll feature a special extended interview with economics professor Richard Wolff on how to reconcile mixed messages about the health of the economy. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
When Representative Duncan Hunter, Republican of California, declared, quote, "I know that at least 10 ISIS fighters have been caught coming across the Mexican border in Texas," close quote, and that dozens more had evaded capture, he was unable to produce any evidence for the claim, which earned him PolitiFact's worst pants on fire rating. Simple enough, right? Well, not for ABC's Martha Raddatz, who teased her version of the story like this.
Up next, were ISIS terrorists caught sneaking across our southern border? Why one congressman's claims are raising alarms?
No one was actually raising alarms, except perhaps for those concerned about Hunter's grip on reality. But Raddatz stretched what should have been a simple fact check into a needless back and forth. She quoted Hunter's office saying that the claim might be reported in the press someday. Quote, "We make the point. Official channels deny. Then maybe in a few years from now, the information will pop up on the front page of the Washington Post." Close quote. Raddatz then went to the head of Homeland Security for a denial. But then back to Hunter, who said Homeland Security hasn't known what it was doing for a long time. Then Raddatz sat down with former Bush administration flack Matthew Dowd, who offered this head-scratcher. Quote, "I think everybody has a right to say what they want to say, but they have the responsibility to say what maybe they believe to be factually correct. The congressman says he believes it to be factually correct." Close quote. There's a standard for you. It's not wrong if Hunter says he believes it was factually correct. Of course, that's not actually how fact-checking works. There must be evidence. Hunter produced none, and neither did any of Raddatz's sources. But the tedious segment left viewers with no clear answer. If ABC can't get an easy one right, can we really expect them to sort out the more complicated stuff?
NPR aired a report out of Wyoming October 9th about how the energy boom is spurring massive demand for new pipelines. The report told listeners that the Interstate Natural Gas Association of America estimates that 500,000 miles of new pipeline will be needed by 2035, noting that that's 20 trips around the earth and then some. We also heard that investment in infrastructure over the next 20 years, including pipelines, transportation, and storage facilities, will add up to $500 trillion, with the note that that's trillion with a T. So, investment, building, what could be wrong? Well, nothing as far as this segment was concerned. Though at the end, there was a suggestion that we should all be thinking about pipelines more. The segment itself was pretty clear about what we should be thinking, namely investment, building. At one point, a reference was made in passing to the fact that three pipelines being planned for North Dakota would have, quote, "a combined capacity of the embattled Keystone XL pipeline," close quote. But NPR listeners would have no idea why Keystone or any pipeline would be embattled, since there was no mention of climate change, pollution, or spills. And maybe that's by design. The report, it was noted, was produced as part of something called Inside Energy, described as a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Getting information on that project or its funders is tricky, though its website does describe it as, quote, "moving beyond polarized arguments and emotional debates," close quote, to explore how energy is made. Well, how NPR jibes that with the mission of public broadcasting, which is expressly to serve as a forum for controversy and debate, is anybody's guess.
Campaign journalism is often pretty shallow. NBC's Chuck Todd provides a case in point. There's a Senate race in Kentucky, and Democratic candidate Allison Lundergan Grimes has surprised many by running only a few points behind heavily favored Republican incumbent Mitch McConnell. But then comes her big problem. She was interviewed by a Louisville paper and asked if she voted for Barack Obama. She refused to give a direct yes or no answer. It was an awkward moment, but not totally surprising since Obama's quite unpopular in her state. The next day, the pundits on MSNBC's Morning Joe were beside themselves. Grimes had made a gaffe they deemed cringeworthy and awful. And Chuck Todd took it even further.
Is she ever going to answer a tough question on anything? You want to be a U.S. senator? It's if you can't say, if you can't find a way to stand behind your party's president, you can disagree with him, but you can't answer that basic question and come across looking that ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she disqualified herself.
I really do.
So the host of Meet the Press thinks that a Senate candidate has disqualified herself for giving an inartful answer to a question that doesn't really matter. We're not talking about a politician who denies the existence of climate change or is advocating for illegal, ill-defined wars. She failed at political theater. For reporters like Chuck Todd, that's an unforgivable sin.
Well, sometimes political coverage is deep, but not in a good way. Since it's never too early to cover the 2016 presidential race, the October 16th New York Times brought us a piece on Hillary Clinton. Under the headline, In South, Clinton Tries to Pull Democrats Back into the Fold, reporter Amy Chozick recalls that Clinton won the Democratic primary in Kentucky in 2008 thanks to a huge advantage among white working-class voters. Okay. Things get slippery in the second paragraph, though, which reads, quote, White Democrats voted for Mrs. Clinton over Mr. Obama by 49 percentage points in 2008, a telling indication of both her strength and Mr. Obama's trouble in attracting traditional Democratic voters, close quote. So is a traditional voter a white voter? The language recalls how in 2008, MSNBC host Chris Matthews frequently talked about Obama's problem connecting with regular Democrats, which seemed to be code for white people. And some whites, according to the New York Times, say Obama's failure to connect with them has Kentucky vulnerable to a Republican rout. Wow, things are so bad there that the state's going Republican? Well, let's look at some numbers. According to exit polls, Obama lost the white vote in Kentucky, 63-36%. But 4 years earlier, in a race between two white guys, George W. Bush won the white vote over John Kerry by the same margin. So maybe the problem is that white Kentuckians really aren't traditional Democratic voters at all. The piece includes one Kentucky Democrat who says, it's nothing personal. People like him are just, quote, nostalgic for when Democrats were different than Obama, close quote. Different than Obama. I wonder what he means by that. Maybe more traditional?
And finally, an October 5th editorial in the Washington Post warned that the U.S. military budget is too small. Barack Obama's increase of foreign military engagements, the paper said, quote, follows years of sweeping cuts in the defense budget. Since 2010, defense spending has been slashed 21% in real terms, according to the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, close quote. Sweeping cuts, slashed spending. How, you may wonder, is the Pentagon scraping by? Hopefully those worried by the editorial saw a subsequent letter to the editor by Miriam Pemberton of the Institute for Policy Studies. Pemberton noted that the Post's hand-wringing editorial left out information that could have provided some context, like the fact that the surge in Pentagon spending after September 11th brought that spending to its highest level since World War II. Quote, despite the budget slashing since 2010, as the editorial described it, Pentagon spending remains higher than all but a couple of years in that period, and it is higher than the defense budgets of the next 11 top spending countries combined, close quote. Pemberton also cited findings of immense waste in Pentagon spending, something that might have occurred to readers as well, perhaps, for instance, while reading the Post October 13th news article about how the Defense Department spent $500 million on transport planes for the Afghan Air Force and then sold most of them for scrap at 6 cents a pound, or $32,000.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
As midterm congressional elections loom, The Washington Post is wondering why Democrats aren't benefiting from all the great economic news. The Wall Street Journal ran a story in September headlined, "Upbeat Economic Reports Signal Sustained Improvement," and a U.S. news story earlier explained the five reasons 2014 is looking good for the U.S. economy. These are just a few examples of the celebratory tone of economic reporting. So are the papers right, or do the people know something the journalists don't? Joining us to talk about this is Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's currently teaching at the New School in New York City. He's also the author of Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Welcome to Counterspin, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, that Washington Post piece that wondered why the Democrats weren't showing up better in polls with the great economic news explained, quote, "The U.S. economy is back on solid ground 6 years after the Great Recession, new data showed Friday," close quote. What's the story here as you see it?
Well, I'm frankly surprised that the Washington Post can't get better reporting than that. The reason the Democrats are not looking good in these midterm elections is precisely because the so-called solid ground or the so-called recovery that we hear about really has only affected the top 5 to 10% of the people, and a large portion of them are traditional Republican supporters, whereas the mass of middle and lower income folks basically have watched a quote-unquote recovery that bypassed the vast majority of the American people. A reasonable person wouldn't call that a recovery, or at least would hedge it about with qualifying adjectives to talk honestly. Just to give you a couple of examples, the median income of an American family, which means 50% earned more, 50% earned less, is about 9% lower today than it was before this crisis hit in 2007. That doesn't mark a recovery. In fact, the line downward is pretty straight down, a deterioration that has really affected the lives and daily existence of the vast majority of Americans. So there really is no recovery, and there is no mystery why what you see in the press is not affecting how masses of people are looking at these elections. And if I could add one more point, if I had time, I would show that, for example, the unemployment decline, much of which is the core of these stories, has more to do with people leaving the labor force, giving up on looking for work so they're no longer counted as unemployed, rather than finding jobs. And for the few that have found jobs, one statistic screams out its importance. 2/3 of those who found jobs during this crisis found jobs paying significantly less than they were earning before the crisis and having typically fewer benefits. So any way you scratch it, this recovery is only that for a tiny minority at the top, and therefore should surprise no one if the mass of people are not happy.
Well, I was just talking about the Washington Post before, but are you seeing the same coverage that we're seeing, lots of journalism celebrating the good economic news?
Yes, and it's really kind of sad, the kindest word I can think of at the moment, to see that, because the journalists ought to know better. They ought to know that any attempt to understand something as complicated as the direction of a huge economy like ours cannot rely on one or two statistics. At any given moment, there are statistics that suggest things are getting better, statistics that suggest things are getting worse, and any prudent, intelligent observer has to be able to weigh all of those things in order to draw a reasonable conclusion. I don't think any reasonable observer would now suggest that the United States is in some sort of wonderful situation on the uptick. This last week, there was a meeting of the IMF in Europe, and basically the tone was unbelievably downbeat and somber, that the prospects for the world economy, including the United States, are very, very frightening in terms of what they're happening. Over the last week, the gyrations of the U.S. stock market were clearly linked to worries about the severity of the downturn in Europe, slowing in China, and so on. So a balanced approach here, which I think most Americans grasp intuitively, if not in the detail, shows that the American people have a better sense of what's happening than the journalists, and that's not a good sign for journalists.
Well, the New York Times, I was able to find two pieces. They've had some coverage pointing out that many of the positive economic indicators don't mean much for most Americans. This reminds me, just to take one example of, I suppose, many, this reminds me of the Chilean miracle, where elites cheered a Chilean economy that could show lots of growth, but it meant very little for most Chileans. Is that true?
Exactly. It was a kind of growth which, if you looked at certain selected indices, looked wonderful on paper. But the minute you looked at other indices, particularly those that were brought forward both by the average person and by more balanced observers, you would have had a much more nuanced picture. I mean, we now know, for example, that the boom we want to recreate, that is the 80s and 90s and the first few years of this century, were so completely dependent on an unsustainable level of consumer debt that it really becomes bizarre to talk about a recovery if you mean going back to where we were, because where we were was on a train heading into a stone wall, and that's hardly what we want to recreate now. So in many ways, it is a misrepresentation of the truth to talk about an economy on solid footing or any such phrases.
Richard Wolff, with so many Americans losing ground, it would seem reasonable to have a discussion of whether capitalism at this stage can no longer sustain the American dream for most of us. Why do you think media often seem so reluctant to have that conversation?
Yeah, I think the answer is our history. You know, after World War II, the business community and the wealthy kind of reached a conclusion that they had been outmaneuvered by the mass of trade unionists in the CIO, by the socialist and communist parties, who had together worked with the president of the time, FDR, to produce Social Security, unemployment compensation, the first minimum wage, and a federal jobs program that employed 15 million people. And all of that was paid for either by taxes on corporations and the rich or by pretty mandatory borrowing of their wealth from them. And they really decided to undo and to prevent that kind of thing from happening again. And they understood correctly that Roosevelt wouldn't have done it had he not been pressured from below by that alliance of the CIO, the greatest union organizing drive in American history, plus the two socialist parties and the Communist Party, who worked very closely together. And so there was a decision to go after that coalition. The first target was its weakest link, the Communist Party. These folks were portrayed as agents of a foreign power and demonized. When that was done, the socialists were equated with the communists. The same was done to them. And we've watched for the last 50 years the step-by-step decimation of the union movement. And so we are now at a point where we've inherited, let's put it this way, we've inherited 50 years in which questioning capitalism, instead of being understood as the sign of a healthy debate about our economic system, one that exposes its flaws and weaknesses alongside of its strengths and achievements, we couldn't do that because talking about the problems of capitalism was basically demonized as a kind of disloyalty. And I think, unfortunately, even though the Cold War is long behind us, its legacy is the failure of leading academics and journalists to throw into question the system, which, given its performance now, this terrible crisis, the second in 75 years, is something that's long overdue to have an honest discussion about whether we can't do better and what the strengths and weaknesses are. And in that context, I was struck today that the latest Nobel Prize was given to two French economists whose entire life work is showing how market economies can run into trouble produce undesirable outcomes, inefficiencies, waste of resources, instead of the usual cheerleading that capitalism is the best thing since sliced bread, I think we're beginning to see a sea change where what we should have been doing for 50 years is once again on the agenda, namely to question our economic system, just like we question our educational system, our medical insurance system, and all the other systems that make up a modern society.
So in looking at the way the corporate press covers this, to take a phrase out of America's radical past, would you say these are the bosses' papers?
Absolutely. They're the papers of the bosses and those who have for so long lived in a country where it was taboo to ask serious questions about capitalism, where it was damaging or frightening to your career prospects to do that. We have a newspaper core that instinctively shies away from asking those questions, even when the mass of people's views and the statistical evidence, or at least the bulk of it, suggests that anything less than that is simply not facing up to the severity of this situation. We are now looking at an economic crisis that begins in 2007. Here we are 7 years later, when the mass of people are worse off in key ways than they were at that time. Their wealth is less, their incomes are less, their job prospects are poorer, their job benefits are fewer. I mean, I could go on and on. I'm a professor. This is the first generation of my students who are accumulating levels of unsustainable debt that is going to hamper their ability to find meaningful work, that is going to deprive us of the productivity we could have got if we would do what every other advanced industrial country does, which is basically subsidize higher education because it's a national treasure to have an educated population, et cetera, et cetera. I think that taboo has to be broken. We live in a country that shows through its dealings with gay marriage and 100 other issues that we are capable of breaking taboos. Well, we should certainly break the taboo on asking systemic questions about an economic system that simply is not delivering the goods to the mass of people, which, after all, was its defense and was its self-congratulations for the last 200 years.
Well, you know, here at FAIR, we've documented in the past how they used to have labor pages. That coverage has now been subsumed into the business pages.
Yes.
The point of view is almost always from a corporate point of view. Again, the boss's papers. What if they weren't the boss's papers? Say you're an editor at a paper that would take a broader view.
Well, for example, just to pick up on an earlier theme of this interview, I would send my reporters out and I would figure out a cross-section of the people in the area that I serve, supervisory personnel, skilled workers, semi-skilled workers, retail workers, industrial manufacturers, all the different basic categories, and I would have my reporters go out and ask them how life has been, how their jobs and job situations have been for them and their spouses, for their children, over the last 7 years, and draw a picture of what this crisis has meant, rather than rely on two or three big indicators that the government touts to come to their conclusions about what has happened. I'm amazed, as you are, that we simply don't see that. We see endless stories about a recovery that a few statistics support, and that is mainly self-congratulations by the political and business leaders. And we don't see what ought to be, which is, let's get the evidence on the ground from the people who have been living through this, and then we can form some sort of picture, which, by the way, would quickly reveal who has recovered and why and how, and who has not recovered and why and how, and would allow the reader to see for himself or herself what the reality is and assess their own situation. For a moment, if I could add, there's a kind of psychological cruelty going on in the media. If you keep telling people who are not, in fact, experiencing a recovery because it isn't there for the mass of people, if you keep telling them there is a recovery, then what you have is a high likelihood that the individuals who are not finding themselves in an improved situation, who are not recovering, will feel that somehow they as individuals are somehow unable to participate in the recovery, which they're told is all around them. And that risks them turning in on themselves, coming to the conclusion that they are failures, that they are inadequate, that there's something wrong with them. And that only worsens the fact that they are, in fact, the victims of this situation and not its perpetrators. And the media ought to do a better job of honestly portraying the very mixed picture of what's going on, because it's cruel to tell people that they are the exception when, in fact, the rule you present as such isn't the case.
FAIR has published many media studies on the Iraq War, on labor. And time and again, we have shown how homeless people, people who live in poverty, workers, union organizers, union members are pretty much invisible in the media. So that would be one thing that you would reverse.
Absolutely. I'd put them front and center. They are the majority. They are the people most like the majority of your readers. You know, there's an old joke that it's very popular in Europe, in particular in Germany. It has to do with the waning months of the Nazi regime in Germany. And two Germans are portrayed in this joke looking at the Rhine River from a hill. And one turns to the other and says, "Isn't it wonderful that Germany is still prospering? Germany is doing well despite the war. There's an immense traffic up and down the Rhine of barges showing this wonderful sign." And the other person says to him, "Hans, we're looking at the Rhine. There's no boat in sight. Nothing's happening." And Fritz says to Hans, "No, no, no. To understand the economy, you don't look at the Rhine to see the traffic on the Rhine. You look in the newspaper." And, you know, the joke being that the newspaper presents the reality that those who control the newspapers wish to have everybody believe. But it's not a reliable source if it isn't in the hands of the mass of people. It's going to serve those in whose hands it does lie. And that goes to the core of the problem of a free press when you allow large corporations to basically own most of them.
We've been speaking with Richard Wolff, professor of economics, currently teaching at the New School in Manhattan. He's also the author of Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Richard Wolff.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the national media watch group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.